Is this a farewell tour?
No. No, it's not. The next one probably will be, but I got three more books, the Dark Tower series, to finish up, and I would like to get out and spread the word that people who've been holding back on those books, now the whole story's there and they can read them. So there's actually a message to get out, where this time with Buick 8, all I can say is, it's a book, it's out, you can buy it if you want to. That's it.
And it'll scare you.
And it'll scare you. Yeah.
Mm. Well, why the talk? First of all, how old are you now? You're only in your mid-50s, right?
Early I'm 50s? 27. Yeah. I thought you knew that.
Well, besides being 27.
I'm 55. Right. I had to think about it because I had my birthday last week.
Mm. So at 55, prime of your career, why all this talk swirling around about Stephen King's ready to say goodbye, hang it up, put it away?
Well, it's not the prime of my career. You know, I've written, I think, 52 books. So that isn't even a book a year for the course of my career. That's like a book a year for my life, taking the first 3 years off to get toilet trained.
Is that necessary for writing a book? Or
no, actually, it's not. It's better if you're not. You got more to write about. But I got to a point where I'm looking at Buick 8, which is a book about a haunted car. And if that sounds familiar, it's because I wrote a book called Christine. This one's entirely different. But I see signs.
He's a boy.
Yeah, he's a boy. Yeah, that's right. Good one. Yeah. But I see signs that I'm getting to a point where I pretty much said what I have to say. I certainly had to finish the Dark Tower books. I was telling you the story about the grandmother who wrote me a letter, and she'd read the fourth volume, and she said, I'm 82, and I have this disease, and I have that disease, and I don't have long to go. So maybe you just write me a letter and sort of tell me how it comes out. And I promise that I won't tell a soul.
And did you?
I didn't know.
Yeah, because you don't know if it's really a grandmother or just some 17-year-old kid who's come up with a good scheme.
Not only that, but I didn't know how it came out, because I'm not that kind of writer. I don't have everything planned out in advance.
Well, that now they are actually very close to finish. In fact, you were telling me you're just working on them now.
Three pages.
You actually stop yourself 2-3 pages from the end and give you delayed gratification of finishing the book until you get home or something?
No, it sounds like Jack Nicholson talking about sex in Chinatown, doesn't it? Have sex for a while, smoke a cigarette, you know. No, I mean, I wanted to finish it at home. I didn't want to finish it in a hotel room in Dearborn.
You don't break the routine at all when you travel around or go on vacation? You take a computer with you or something like that?
Yeah, I do. And you're the last one that can put a knock on me about that, because I played with the remainders, and I know, you know, it's 2 o'clock, Mitch has got a break and go to a studio in Denver or Tacoma or someplace like that and do the radio show.
Now, so I've written in the back of taxi cabs, sitting against the wall in airports. I find as soon as the screen actually comes up and the words appear, it takes me about 60 seconds to zone in on it, and it really doesn't matter who's walking around. If I'm anxious to do it, I can do it. Are you the same way?
Yeah, I am. I am the same way. And I remember reading one time that Truman Capote said he loved to write in hotel rooms and motel rooms, because you close the door and there's nobody saying, honey, you have to dump the garbage. Honey, the dog just went on the floor. Would you clean it up? I'm doing this or that or the other thing. And when you're actually telling a story, I think the worst thing in the world you can do is stop, and you kind of forget what you were up to.
Mm. You were talking with Stephen King here on the Mitch Albom Show. You have written a book about how you write, in addition to suggestions for other people, which is a wonderful book. It's called On Writing, and in there you talk about where you write and over the years how it's changed. Some people think that when you get a lot of money and you can afford a nice place, you'd actually set up this grand studio at the top of a tower and overlook the world. But in point of fact, you can actually concentrate better if you're looking at nothing, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I've got a room upstairs that actually used to be my daughter's bedroom until she moved out, and I just moved in a desk and changed a couple of pictures. And when I moved in the desk, I made sure that it faced away from the windows so that I wouldn't even be looking out at the driveway, because once you are, then you want to go there and see if the Federal Express man is coming. Right. You want to see what's going on in the world, so you turn it away, you face the wall. The same way people say, do you listen to music when you write? And I do, but generally it's the most boring, repetitive music that I can possibly find. I've been working on these Dark Tower books for about 15 months now, and all I've been listening to is Lou Bega, Mambo Number 5. I've got a vinyl recording that's got four versions of Mambo Number 5. There's the radio version, there's the dance mix, there's a couple of instrumentals, and one day I'm listening to it, and in between cuts, I hear my wife downstairs. She's talking to somebody, and she's saying, "He just does it to spite me." I'm like, "No, honey." A little bit of Sandra in my life, a little bit of Rita for my wife.
And you can write through that.
Yeah.
And the words don't come out a little bit of...
No.
Huh, that's amazing.
No, it just goes right in. And it's something else that I've got that I discovered that I really liked is a dance mix by a group called L.A. Style. It's called James Brown is Dead. And I love
and
that.
And you're right
too.
To that. How yeah. could you think of giving up a life like this? I mean, you know.
It's hard, Mitch. It's hard.
Life of Mambo Number 5 forever and a day.
It's pretty glamorous,
well,
I'll tell you.
What would, what happens at 57, 58, 59, 60, all those years, if not right?
I'll probably go back to it. I mean, I'm like a junkie who's saying, I'm going to quit, you know. I don't know what's going to happen. I've taken breaks in between books, and you get a little bit antsy after a while. The ideal situation, I think, would be if I were able to continue to write and fulfill myself that way and spend the 4 hours a day or 5 hours a day and maybe just put the stuff aside, and then after I croak, the literary executor, who will probably be my wife, because she didn't smoke two packs a day all her life the way that I did until I was about 40 years old. She can look at this stuff and she might find three or four things that she thinks are worth publishing, and that would be great. But my fear is a lot of people are looking at you. I mean, I'm on the cover of this magazine.
Entertainment Weekly.
Entertainment Weekly. You get written up in the New York Times and that sort of thing. I don't really want to embarrass myself if I can help it. I mean, I'm like a ball player in the sense that I don't need to go out with a home run like Ted Williams, but I'd love to go out with a ground rule double.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be nice.
Stephen King is our guest here. We're going to take a brief break and come back and talk more with him on the Mitch Albom Program.
Album!
We're back here on the Mitch Albom Program with Stephen King, who's joining us here in the studio. A little later on, we will get to the part about him singing with the Rock Bottom Remainders.
Where your grandma and my grandma.
Now that's frightening.
We'll get to that. We've got a trove of Stephen King material.
We've
got a jukebox.
That's exactly what
I'm
afraid
ready for another tour.
Let me finish up to talk about, you know, what people are saying might be an interruption of your career, if not the end of it. But by looking back a little bit, a lot of people don't know that Steve began actually teaching. He didn't come out of the womb writing horror books, lived a pretty poor life for a good long stretch. And I remember you telling me when you got the letter about Carrie, the paperback, and how they were going to pay you whatever they were going to pay you for the paperback. I think it was $400,000 or something. And you kept looking at the letter over and over again, because basically what you were holding in your hand was the key to a life change. Until that point, it was, you know, still write for pulp magazines. Didn't you write for virtually every adult gentleman's magazine back then, just trying to get stories?
Yeah, but based on the ads in the back, not many of them were gentlemen. It was I wrote for whoever would pay the bills. You know, I was making $6,200 a year teaching high school English, and I liked the work, I liked the kids, but I didn't like the hours, and I didn't like coming home at the end of the day feeling as though you were kind of flat, a lot of your energy was gone. $6,200 wasn't enough for a wife and two kids, even back in the early 70s. So I had a little side gig with these stories, and I was selling to a dude, gent, Cavalier was one of the big markets. I never hit, you know, the glossy slicks like Playboy and Penthouse until later
on. Were they horror stories even then?
Or? Most of them were horror stories, but not all of them. Some of them were hard crime stories.
Uh-huh.
But most of them were horror stories, and my mother was still alive then, and I wanted her to be proud of me. So Tabby would photocopy the stories, the columns, and she'd put stuff, you know, masking over the, you
the
know,
dirty
the,
parts.
The ads for Stag films.
Didn't your mom ever say, why don't you just send me the magazine? You don't have to send me a photocopy.
She never did, which makes me think she probably knew.
Your mom know that you wanted to be a writer? Did she nurture that when you were younger in any way?
She did, yeah. She read us stories. I can remember being out on the front porch. We grew up in Stratford, Connecticut, and, you know, she'd work all day. She had a job in a laundry. And I had a job in a laundry for a couple of years, and I remember thinking it's gone full circle. I went to college for 4 years, and the only job I could get was, you know, pushing sheets in an industrial laundry. But she'd come home, and we'd go out on the porch, and she'd read us things like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde or Agatha Christie mystery novels, that sort of thing. It was great.
Do you think that is endemic to becoming a writer, that at some point early on, somebody introduce you to the love of reading or put it inside you?
I do. I don't think there's any question about it. And she bought me my first typewriter, too, which was really the key. I mean, you're right. I never heard it put that way. I got the call saying that Carrie had sold to paperback for $400,000. And at that time, you split 50-50 on paperback rights with the hardcover publisher. So it was only $200,000. But I understood even then that I'd lived such a hand-to-mouth existence for my first earning years that IRS wasn't going to get much of that. It was going to be mine. And it really was the key to a life change. But the key to starting that life, to be able to send stories to magazines, was having a typewriter, because they wouldn't read anything that was handwritten.
It was handwritten, Have any of those been refound or collected or anything, like the Stephen King the Dude years?
Stephen King the Dude years. Yeah. The D cup years, more like it. Most of those stories are available. They're in Night Shift. I'd say most of the Cavalier and Gent, Dude, Adam, all those are in either
Adam.
Adam. Adam
must have missed that one on the rack.
Well, is there
an Eve too? It probably is.
Just Adam, but it was right next to Adam Bedside Reader. Okay, that was the digest.
Stephen King's early years. Did that?
Those magazines, Mitch, had two kinds of fiction. Either they were entirely about sex. They were basically softcore porn, the stories, or there was none at all. And those were science fiction, horror, mystery.
Did you ever try the former?
No, I never did. Yeah. I never did.
Didn't think you'd...
I didn't have the experience for it.
Yeah, as opposed to the experience of, you know, like people ripping each other's hearts out and dogs, evil dogs and cars that are taking over.
All right, you got me. Okay.
Did the that whole experience of sort of starting out that way and seeing a different life, did that steal you for later on when, you know, the inevitable backlash of people saying, well, he's too successful, we have to take him down a peg, or we got to criticize his work, it's not really literary fiction, it's, you know, which you went through for a stretch of time until it seems like the last 5 years, all of a sudden you've been adopted by the New Yorker, everybody loves you. But there was a good long stretch where they wouldn't even bother to review Stephen King books.
Right.
Was your attitude sort of like, hey, I remember what it was like pushing the sheets in the laundry, I don't care what any of you think.
Well, I think that everybody wants respect as well as money. You know, the money is a great thing, but you want somebody to give you a pat on the head and say, kid, you done good. But I always felt like if I kept my head down and did my job and worked as hard as I could to the limits of my talent, that sooner or later I would get some breaks in terms of critical appraisal, if I was any good at all. Mm-hmm. If you're not any good, that doesn't happen. And I'm still not really looking forward to the day when somebody's going to say Stephen King wins the Pulitzer Prize for Literature. I think that's a ways off. Yeah. But you just never give up. You never say to yourself, that's never going to happen. You just say, that probably won't happen.
Would you say you think you're good?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty good. I don't think that I'm great. I think that I have a pretty clear idea of where I am. Maybe if there was a continuum of literary excellence from, let's say, 0 to 100%, and if you were going to put somebody like William Faulkner or William Shakespeare up in that 100th percentile, I think that I might be up around the 75th percentile, somewhere like that.
That'll get you past.
You know, and I think that it might be that you're given a certain amount of talent, but it's a cheap commodity, and I've said this in the On Writing book. Talent's the cheapest thing on earth. It's cheaper than table salt. Everybody's got some kind of a talent, whether it's a musical instrument or whether it's the ability to write, draw, paint, caricature, whatever. There's something there. A lot of it has to do with how much work you're willing to do to refine it. So in the course of my career, I've worked hard, I've read a lot, and I think that one of the magic moments that comes for every writer is when you read a book. Usually this happens when you're fairly young, and you say to yourself, I do better than this. Mm-hmm. I can do better than this right now. And that's an important thing, where you're actually able to get a little self-esteem and say to yourself, I deserve to be in this league. I deserve to play with these guys.
We'll come back with Stephen King here on the Mitch Albom program. Lots more. We'll talk about movies, music, and all the rest. Stay with us. Our guest here on the Mitch Albom program is Stephen King, whose latest book is called From a Buick 8. And you've actually gone out and promoted this a little bit, which over the course of your career, you do some books you don't do at all. Other ones, I remember there was one when you went down to Australia and didn't you ride across the whole continent on a motorcycle?
I did.
That's the ultimate promotion.
Mm. Well, I rode across America on a motorcycle, too, to promote Insomnia, and that was a great trip. I left in October from Maine and ended up in Santa Clara, California. Stuck the Harley in a moving van and they brought it back across the country.
What was your recognizability quotient across America?
Well, back then in 96, there were always a few that would say, hey, aren't you Steven Spielberg? And I'd say, that's right. E.T. phone home. No, there were always a few that recognize you because they know the pictures on the back of the book. But since then, I've done cameos in a number of movies, and I've been on the cover of some magazines, and they want you to go around and do the morning shows when you get a book that comes out. And a lot of times, I'm a partner now with a publisher. We split 50-50. If the books succeed, we both make out, and if they don't succeed, they don't. And so I have a tendency to say, well, I want them to feel good about the relationship, so I'll do them. But you do get this thing where once you do one of those morning shows, you go around and a lot of people recognize you. Yeah. So it's and for a writer, I always feel like that's not the way that it's supposed to be, because writers are supposed to be like secret agents, you know, that we're observing life and what goes on and then reporting back, and that becomes tougher to do.
Any of your fans ever scare you?
Yeah, sometimes they do. There was a guy, I did a signing in Dearborn just yesterday, and there was one guy there who's just holding up a picture of my house. And he wouldn't say anything to anybody. And they security people went over and said, well, do you want a book sign? And he wouldn't say anything. He just held up the picture of the house. And finally he said to one of them, I've got something for him. You know, and that made him nervous, and they kind of hustled him out. So, yeah, sometimes they scare me.
Yeah, I'm scared, and I wasn't even there.
You weren't even there, no.
Wasn't there a female fan who lit her fingernails on fire during one of the Rock Bottom Remainders concerts?
Yeah, there was. There was. They were like these candles. They were just there, and
I mean, that inspired Dave Barry to turn to one of the band people and say, I don't ever want to be that famous. I think that's probably right. You kind of brought that to a lot of people's attention with one of your books, which became one of the many, many popular movies that have been made out of Stephen King's books. Aren't there now over 30 now that have been actually been turned into films?
I think probably more like 40
Closer
or 45. 40. Yeah.
That, of course, being Misery with James Caan and Kathy Bates.
Many in 1871, women often died in childbirth. But her spirit is the important thing, and Misery's spirit is still alive.
I don't want her, bitch! I want her! And you murdered her!
No, I didn't.
Who did?
No one. She died. She just slipped away.
Slipped away?
No, my ankle hurts just listening.
The ankle scene, man.
A lot of people think that was, you know, Stephen King putting out the book in which the protagonist was actually Stephen King. Was there any?
No, I don't think so. I learned a number of things writing that book. The writer's name was Paul Sheldon, and at the beginning of the book, Paul has just written what he thinks of as his breakthrough novel. He's had a series of these bodice-ripping romances featuring Misery Chastain, and he's finally cut the cord. He kills Misery in childbirth. That's the end of his last Misery book. He's got money in the bank, and he's written this so-called serious novel called Fast Cars, and that's where he is when Annie Wilkes kidnaps him. And one of the things that he discovers in the course of the book, when Annie forces him to write another Misery book, is that what he was built for were these popular entertainments, and that he wasn't really cut out for the life of literary excellence. And that's sort of the thing that I've come to over the years. I'm really, this is what I do, this is what I am, and after a while you have to accept yourself, and that's the first step to getting to really be happy.
Well, then there was a lot of Stephen King in that character.
There was.
Just not the way that people thought. They thought you were writing about your relationship with fans, but in point of fact, you were actually writing about your relationship to your own work. Don't you live right out kind of in plain sight up there in Maine? I mean, everybody could, if you could, you could just basically land in Bangor and ask somebody, you know, where's Stephen King's place, and they could sort of point you to it, right?
Yeah.
You're not hiding from anyone.
You can go by and check out the house. It's got a big fence around it to keep people from going and tearing up my wife's flowers and stuff like that. But I remember, okay, we've got a place that I'm not going to say where it is. It's in the western part of the state, over in the Lakes region. And we spend a lot more time there. And for me, the break point came one day. We've got this nice dog, and I had him out one day on his leash. And he's looking for a place to do his business. You know the way they do. They kind of sniffing around. Nope, that won't do. Maybe, yeah, over here. Yep, this is a good place. And he's getting all settled down, and I'm watching, you know, because it's drizzling, and I want to get him done and get him in. And I hear click, 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 all these little clicking noises. And I look up. There's a tour bus parked out front. There are 60 Japanese tourists off this tour bus, all with their little Minoltas, and they're all taking a picture of my dog doing his business. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is not what it's supposed to be.
And this was in the private house, wow. Supposedly.
This was in the house in Bangor, but I'm lucky, and the way that I think about it is, I can't imagine what it would be like to be Madonna, or Tom Cruise, or Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods, somebody like that, or Mitch Albom. how you do that? How do you live with that? I mean, do you run into this? You must. I mean, you've done a lot of TV.
Yeah, but I don't inspire craziness as much as I just do, you know, sports passion or Tuesdays with Maury questions.
Uh-huh.
It's not, you know, I can live with it.
Yeah, but don't you?
I've never had a bus of tourists taking pictures of my dog.
You get the guy with the hat with the two beers in it, right?
Yeah,
and a little swizzle straw.
The moose hat, the two straws. Want to hit Mitch?
Yeah, right.
That's what I get. That's my crowd.
Mitch knows he's in trouble when the guy comes up, isn't wearing a shirt, and half of his face is painted blue.
Stephen King is visiting here with us. I played you that clip from Misery. Not only have so many of your books been turned into movies, but lately, really excellent movies that get nominated for Academy Awards, and that seems to be the pattern. What turned that? Was there a point at which they went from, you know, well, we're just going to make a Pet Cemetery or Carrie, to we're going to try to make Hearts in Atlantis, you know, this big kind of picture, and maybe an Academy Award for its star and things like that? When did that turn?
I think it started with a film that Rob Reiner made called Stand By Me. And Stand By Me was based on a novella called The Body. There's no monsters in it. It's just a story about four kids that are out on a walk to try and find a dead body. It does have a little of that Stephen King thing going. But I think that it was the Castle Rock people who saw that the stories were mostly about people and not about monsters.
Would you like to do more of that, even more movie work, more write a movie from scratch?
Well, that's why all the talk about retirement is a little bit premature. I've got a number of things that are commitments that I have to finish up, and one of them is a TV series for ABC called Kingdom Hospital, and it's 15-16 hours. It has to do with a hospital that's built on unhallowed ground, and it's a chance, again, you know, it looks like a horror story, it walks like a horror story, it talks like one, but there's also all this stuff about satire of doctors, and there's a chance to do a real kind of anti-ER. Beyond that, I've agreed to try and write a Broadway show with John Mellencamp.
Heard about that. He talked about that with us when we had him on as well. That should be pretty interesting.
You get all the good guys.
Yeah. I will take a break. By the way, Stand By Me, the film. Here's a little version of Stephen King with the Rock Bottom Remainders doing that song.
Oh, God.
Here's Stephen King on lead and guitar.
I won't cry. I won't cry. No, I won't shed a tear. Just as long as you stand.
Come on.
Darling, darling, stand,
stand by me,
by me.
Stand by.
Oh, stand.
Album.
And we're back here with Stephen King visiting with us in the studio here on the Mitch Album Program. His latest book, From a Buick Gate, is already a huge bestseller.
But that shouldn't stop everybody in your audience from going out and buying two.
What was the what was the single biggest selling book that you wrote?
Green Mile.
Green Mile.
That was a really interesting thing, and
you did it in six chapters. I remember I waited every month to get the little
paperback
that came out.
Book. Yeah,
small,
they were $1.95.
Like buying donuts, you know,
yeah.
You just get one. So you're counting all the six chapters of that plus the actual solid book of it.
Well, when you think about it, the way that it worked out was that those single volumes, the little paperback volumes, sold probably 2 million copies apiece. So that was 12 million, and then it was released as a finished paperback, and it sold another 4 million, and then it was released as a hardcover from Scribner's, and it did another 2 million in hard.
Wow.
So that was helped by the film that came along.
Yeah.
And so I would say that all told, that sold somewhere in the neighborhood of 18 million copies. And for a while, I had six books on the New York Times bestseller list because there were six different volumes.
Right, I remember that. Yeah, that's a way to dominate.
And then they had a big controversy where all these other publishers said, well, that isn't really fair, damn it. That's all the same book, and he's hogging all the spaces. So they've changed things now.
Here's a little from the movie version of The Green Mile.
Tell me what you want me to do. You want me to take you out of here? Just let you run away? See how far you could get?
How would you do such a foolish thing?
On the day of my judgment, when I stand before God, and he asks me, why did I kill one of his true miracles? What am I going to say? That it was my job. It was my job.
You tell God, the Father, it was the kindness you done.
That was a terrific film.
It
and,
was.
Tom Hanks, I don't know, when you got Tom Hanks vying to be a lead in a movie version of your book, that's pretty good stuff, isn't
that's,
it?
That's awesome, and I thought that it was an awesome movie. It was long, it was generous, it's the sort of movie that the critics didn't care much for, and the public just couldn't get enough of. Yeah. It was kind of an R-rated Hallmark Hall of Fame thing. Yeah. It was, you know, sort of a family movie in a way.
Do you still have, I mean, for all the fame that comes to you, is there still a little boy looking up at a movie star kind of thing when you go to the sets with some of these people?
There kind of is. The longer I live, the more I have a tendency to look at these people just as talented people. And I think that a guy like Tom Hanks is a resource.
Mm-hmm.
Or you, for that matter. I mean, that you can sit down and do this day after day. That's a wonderful thing, but when I look at you, I mean, obviously you're somebody that I worship deeply,
right.
But, you know, I think that we're equals in the sense that we both do something that people like, and people are fortunate to have us, but on the other hand, where would we be without the audience?
Mm. Well, what a segue into the Rock Bottom Remainders portion of this talk, which for those people who don't know, Stephen, myself, Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, Amy Tan, Kathy Goldmark, Roy Blunt Jr., and a whole host of other people who have kind of come in and out of the band. It's sort of like Spinal Tap's drummers, you know, 16, 17 of them. It's kind of hard to keep track of. But basically, we've kind of sunk down to like going 1 week a year now on tour and we're a loud band, and we're punctual. That's about the two good things you can say about
right.
us. We're not actually in tune.
We're not punks, but we're punctual. No.
Right. But Stephen can actually play some guitar. Now, we pulled this off. This is Stephen King's guitar here. This is the start of that song, High School Sweater.
High School Sweater, that is, yeah.
It's pretty good. Until we start singing it, it's actually not bad.
Yeah, no.
Now, is this the black guitar? Or is this the
I don't know.
That's the Farrington.
Is that the guitar that has the spiders on
it? It doesn't have the spiders on it. You know, the famous thing was when Dave Berry was showing me how to do bar chords, you know, I said to him, oh, I know, E is the third spider down.
Why do you think you like doing that? I mean, I know my reasons, but you certainly don't need to be out playing with a pickup rock and roll garage band.
Yeah, but as a writer, what I do is something that I do all alone. It's a one-person sport. The band, the way that you played, I think in your earlier days was akin to what I did with the men's magazines, wasn't it?
I mean,
it was
extra. You had to pay the rent.
Yeah. And this is more for fun, and we get together. We all talk the same language. Nobody asks somebody else in the band, where do you get your ideas? Yeah. Because everybody knows we don't know where we get our ideas. We get something that we don't get somewhere else, which is just the idea of relaxing with other writers, and it's just a blast to go on stage.
Here's Stephen King, and actually, when it gets to the chorus, you'll hear me. So this is the two of us. I'm singing behind. Yeah,
I need the long tape.
Ico.
The
old Dixie Cups tune.
Where your grandma and my grandma sitting by the fire? My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your ass on fire. Talk about hey now, Ico, one day. Shakamovino, Shakamovino.
There you go.
Shakamovino.
You rock, Mitch.
things you thought you'd never do. Well, that's enough of that. Good recording technique there, too, by the way.
Yeah, it was.
How's the groupie business with you guys now?
You know,
the rock about made them groupies.
Stephen and I came out of a hotel once, I remember, with a couple other members of the band in Chicago at about 7:30 or so in the morning to catch a cab to the airport.
Mm-hmm. We had two nuns, right?
No. We hadn't told anybody where we were, where we were staying. We had only arrived the day before. We didn't tell anybody when we were leaving. It just so happened we met in the lobby. We walk out the door. The distance from the hotel door to the cab is 30 yards. We go 10 yards, and we are swooped upon by a bunch of people with Stephen King books and say, Mr. King, these people must have slept there all night because it wasn't like we had a schedule that says, oh, it's 7:20 in the morning, they're coming out. And before we got to the car, you were surrounded by these people asking you for something.
Yeah, but they weren't exactly the Banger Sisters.
No, they weren't the Banger Sisters. That's the kind of groupies we get. Well, finally, of talking about things that you never thought you'd do, and certainly I never thought it'd be play in a band where Stephen King was, but I want to end by asking you about the accident that happened to you a couple of years ago, and thank goodness you look great and you're walking around. I know how you look and how you feel are frequently different, and we've seen that when we've been on tour. But that whole incident, when it was all put in perspective, has it given you anything in terms of thinking, like, did it happen for some kind of purpose? Were you supposed to have something? What now, a few years later, do you think about that?
Well, all I know is I survived it, and that gives you some perspective on how much you actually have in terms of the ability to come back from something. It's an experience that I don't think about any more than I have to. It was not a pleasant time in my life. Now, I still have a lot of residual pain from it, but I also got some material out of it for the On Writing book. I mean, I don't advise anybody to jump in front of a van to get material for a book, but the most important thing is you live and you just make this deal with yourself and say, this must have happened for a reason, because there's no other way to handle it.
Well, this may not be the last book from Stephen King. It certainly isn't, because the Dark Tower series is going to finish up. So
anyway,
he's already committed to three more. He's got two pages left on one. But From a Buick Gate is out there, and you should go get two copies.
Two.
That's
two
what Stephen
least.
Told me to say, get at least two copies.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what happens next. Movies, Broadway plays, rock concerts, whatever.
The remainders, my dream is to open for the Stones.
Well, you could open for the Stones. The rest of us,
we
could cater for the Stones.
It's got to be the band.
But I don't think we could open for them. Stephen, it's great to see you.
It is.
Thank you for
spending
so much
time.
Good to hang around with you. Stephen King, From a Buick Gate, is a book.